Us. Want to start out with an informal poll. Imagine you're a high school student. Raise your hand if you would be happy to have ChatGPT at your disposal. Okay, so I think most of us agree that, we're onto something here with this emerging tech and AI. So today we're going to talk about what role it should play in the classroom and also how we can still kind of keep that human side of things. I want to start out, though, by asking everyone on our panel to introduce themselves and tell us a little bit about their company. So I'll start with you, Mehdi.
Thank you so much for having me on this stage. I'm excited. I'm a ChatGPT user, I think daily user at this point. So my name is Mehdi Basiri. I'm the co-founder and CEO at ApplyBoard. ApplyBoard helps international students to go abroad. So far, we have helped over 750,000 international students with their journey. And of course, we use AI and machine learning since very early stage to support the students with their choice.
Wonderful. And Mary, tell us a bit about Roots of Empathy.
Hi. Well, I have to make a public confession. I'm a ChatGPT virgin. So I'm in good company, right? You'll be gentle. So I'm the founder and president of Roots of Empathy, and this is a global organization where we work with young school children to help them develop empathy by working with an infant and a parent. It's not as simple as it may sound or as cute. There's a lot of research to take care of the cuteness. But we are on three continents, and we work in seven languages. And the long and the short of it is, when empathy goes up, as it does with these little children, aggression and bullying goes down, stays down. But the good thing is, the pro-social behavior, the including, the kindness, sharing, caring, all of those things go up and stay up over time.
Wonderful. And Josh, yeah?
Yeah, so I'm Josh. I am co-founder and CEO at Mindstone. We turn daily learning into quantifiable skills that employers recognize. I'm also an LP and a VP with Emerge Education. They're one of the most active early-stage education venture firms in Europe and an angel in about 40 different startups, mostly focused on impact and education.
And I want to go down the line here because I think each of you kind of represent different parts of the educational experience and meeting people wherever they are at in life. Mehdi, how is the classroom experience changing when we're thinking about college students and people pursuing post-secondary degrees?
I think in the next 5 to 10 years, I think we're gonna see a significant change in education, and I think it's long due because education sector or education institution hasn't been that adaptive to technology past decade or so when you really compare them to rest of the sector. So I think it's a lot of challenges still to overcome. It's still ChatGPT or the AIs is still very new, and a lot of institutions need to also adopt their way of thinking on utilizing those tools. But I truly believe next 5 years, we're going to be working a lot smarter, and a lot of institutions are going to add more experience to their classrooms versus the traditional schooling.
And Joshua, a lot of what Mindstone does is really self-driven learning, right? How is tech transforming that? If I wanted to learn something maybe 20 years ago, I might have gone on to, the early days of the internet or gone to a library. But how is it changing when people are looking for themselves?
Right, so I'd say today we're learning from everything and everyone around us. It's much more just in time. The faster the world moves around us, the more quickly we need to adapt, the less the current structures are well suited to try and train us up within that, right? If the average lifetime of a skill's value is 4 or 5 years and a degree takes 3 or 4 to go and get, it's very hard to get the value out of that. I think from an AI perspective, one of the things that is not as much talked about, we talk about generative AI, the ability to create stuff, but actually these models have they have an inference ability as well. So they can actually look at the quality of a question or an answer, and they can grade it based on the rubrics that we provide, so what we think is good. I think there's a lot that we can do within feedback loops to help guide people to learn.
Definitely. And Mary, when we're thinking about, you know, the younger kids in school, especially the last few years, kids having to go to virtual school during the pandemic, how is tech changing there? How are you seeing it being used in the classroom?
Well, I think it's being used very cleverly and appropriately. There's very little tech application right now to the children grade 8 and under in the ChatGPT, and I think that's appropriate. I think in many instances the children are more tech savvy than their teachers. And I think that's a good thing. I think also we have to be careful that we don't allow the use of technology and the current things we're speaking of, which are beyond exciting, we don't allow it to eclipse our humanity, that we make sure we build in extra doses in the classroom of children to use their reflective capacities and to use their empathic capacities, to really allow them to have time to relate with one another, because you get so involved with your technology, sometimes to the exclusion of others, although there are wonderful social programs as well. So it's changing, but I can tell you, as fast as you say everything's changing, and I believe you, you know, you get a neck swivel there. But I think children are not changing. Their mental health is changing. Their anxiety levels are changing. They're no different from when you were. They need to know there's someone there for them. They get just as embarrassed as you would have at 7 if you didn't know where you were. So I think it's really important that we marry up the discussion of the normal sort of expected development of children compared to the fast pace of the world in which they live. So the people who are introducing all the wonderful technology, we need to work with them to make sure they understand the receivers.
And Metti, I want to ask you, you know, on the other side of things, what do educators need to do to really lean in and embrace this technology?
At the first stage, they have to agree and understand that the technology is there and it's changing fast. I believe that, again, like education sectors, right now AI is a big topic everywhere, but I think faculties are still yet to catch up how that's going to affect their work. As simple as, like, we do work with a lot of faculties, a lot of professors, as simple as right now writing a normal reference letter. Is it written by you or is it written by ChatGPT? How do we know if it's really, and ChatGPT does an amazing job, I think, in the writing this. Empathy is a big question, is still there. So I think a lot of them are still figuring out how they're going to adopt. And there is a lot of tools now coming out that they're recognizing whether it's been written by AI. So now we have anti-AI driven things. So it's exciting time, but I believe in the next 2 to 3 years, a lot of institutions will figure out. But also we have to recognize pandemic really shooken up institution, going from never having a hybrid classes, going to full online and changing the equipment, getting the process. So now they're coming post-pandemic, and now ChatGPT and AI is coming. So I believe in the next 2 to 3 years is where a lot of them will figure out how they will survive or adapt to this technology.
And Joshua, I wanted to ask you, what are some benefits you see to having AI as a part of the equation when we're in a learning environment?
So ironically, I actually think that one of the biggest advantages we can get out of AI is to try and train the skills that are that were hard to train before. So for example, an ability to communicate effectively, or an ability to understand the other side of an argument. AI is really good at navigating these ambiguous spaces. We all know that it hallucinates, and so in a space where you need a very particular answer to something, a little bit harder. But in a space where there's room for ambiguity, where you're trying to understand nuance, it is able to be a partner that provides a feedback loop that otherwise you can't get. We were talking about before how kids, for example, would still be scared to ask questions. Well, they will be less scared to ask questions to an AI. And so the questions that currently are not getting surfaced, that are not getting feedback, they will in the future. And just to expand on that a little bit more, so David Epstein wrote this book called Range, and he talks about kind and wicked environments, how kind is an environment where you get a quick feedback loop, and wicked is one where you don't. So like investment is a very wicked environment. You make a decision, you might learn a result in 10 years, and then it comes back, and you still don't know if it went wrong, why it went wrong. But AI is able to, when you make a decision, first and foremost, give you five different scenarios of how it might play out. Suddenly you think about the scenarios. As you get the feedback, you can ask for more details in the feedback. It is always there instantly, and if it's not clear enough, you ask it for more details. It's not going to be perfect. These are simulated environments. But the feedback loop around the simulation is something we've never had available before. And if that feedback loop is what holds us from a learning perspective, it's something that's about to be unlocked, and it's going to have dramatic results, I think.
So you mentioned that AI does hallucinate, and we know that, and that's one of the problems that companies are continuously working on. It also can introduce misinformation. Do you think we need to have some sort of like an AI literacy campaign to reach everyone to understand these problems?
Absolutely, yeah. So I think it was Ethan Mollick, actually. He was one of the first people to kind of publicly talk about the idea that we have these systems. We've been trained to think about systems as infallible, as being either black or white. And as weird as it sounds, a better framework to evaluate how to think about AI is to think about them as a person. It's not a person. I'm not saying any of that, to be very clear. But a person hallucinates. I would argue that most people hallucinate more than AI does. But once you think about the input and the output of the AI as a person, and you think, okay, this is not a piece of information I should just take as granted. I should double check it. It comes from a thing. It will have a bias. It starts to become much more powerful once you take that frame of reference. And I think most people are still evaluating it as a system, even though it reacts differently to how we have previously acted with systems. So yes, lots of education of how we should think about this in the first place.
And Mary, at what point do we start talking to kids about this? I mean, these young kids are growing up with ChatGPT and all sorts of other AI systems. There's a AI buddy on Snapchat that I believe is powered by ChatGPT. When do we start talking to them about this so they can understand, you know, this is, you know, an AI versus a real person?
Well, there's an interesting perspective on that from the Surgeon General in the United States, who believes that children under 16 should not be on social media, so God knows what he'd say about, I don't know, I don't think it would be good. But I'd love to pick up on one of your points, and we had chatted just a bit behind the curtain here about children being afraid to ask questions, afraid to be criticized. And the one thing that I'd love to share with you about the work we do with children, we come from a perspective of intrinsic motivation. There's barely anything in this world that works on, it's all extrinsic, it's all first, fastest, and it puts tremendous pressure on children. So I love your point that the children feel a little bit more comfortable to be asking a question, but I can tell you in any situation, if children understand that they're not going to be graded and they're not going to be judged, that if the adults in the classroom, this is what we model in Roots of Empathy, our instructors, ask only questions that are authentic. Like you wouldn't be asking how many legs does a horse have, because everyone knows a horse has four legs, but you would be asking what do you think about and when was the time that you felt like and what do you remember about and what do you hope for. So appealing to children's imagination and to their humanity. And it all works around the idea that when they do say something or they do ask a question, much like a shrink, we say thank you. But we don't evaluate it. They can't believe it. And then when they put up their hands and they want to contribute or they want to ask a question, they're sitting around a green blanket with a little tiny baby on the blanket you can't imagine, but it's true. So they will say, four or five children have up their hands, never, ever do we ask the first child who put up their hand to contribute, because what you're trying to say is some of us need more reflective time and life. Childhood should not be a race, should be a feast. Take your time, we all need to take our time. You don't give children a pound of carrots in one day because you understand carrots are good, just be patient. And so, yeah, I like your idea.
You know, that's a great point. I hadn't thought of using AI in that way for kids. That's really interesting. Now, I want to shift gears, Metti. When we're thinking about students around the world who are looking for that perfect study abroad program and something where they know they'll be successful in it, or at least have a good chance of being successful in it, how has your AI-powered matching service kind of helped people get to where they want to be?
Before I answer that question, one thing that I'm massively and very excited about AI is about 250 million students around the world don't have access to the primary or secondary education. This is like, I'm still surprised, because that means one out of 32 students, or one out of 32 human, pretty much, right? So it's a significant number when you think about it. And I think through AI, we would be able to massively reduce that, because a teacher doesn't need to know now every subject. One teacher can teach a lot more subject, and I truly believe that we would be able to reduce the gap between the accessibility of education through more technology. And in a study abroad, of course, going abroad, I came from Iran to Canada 12 years back, as a significant shift, it's a significant mindset. And it takes about actually 2 billion combination for students to go abroad. So it doesn't seem as hard, but it is very significant and hard. And I challenge people, if you hold a passport that you don't need a visa, or you need a visa for another country, like, think of that process, but make it 100 times harder, because now there is a difference. So through AI and technology, we're trying to simplify that whole process, but also giving the students visibility around their success rate. I think that's the most important. Like, it's a huge investment. Education is a huge investment, but what would be the likelihood of you to be successful out of that education, whether that's your career, whether that's your graduation rate, whether that's your academic rate. So through AI and the projection that we're doing, we would be able to get the students to more the outcome that they want.
And are you seeing any particular trends about what students are looking for right now in a program?
Indeed, I think in pandemic we saw a huge shift, specifically in the health sector and science. Now we're going to, the health sector a little bit has came down. Business management, those that they used to be very popular are becoming less popular. And I think like the easiest disruption of AI is actually the traditional business programs, because it's easily to be thought through AI. You don't really need that. So science and health is something that has been very popular, specifically pandemic has accelerated that. So.
Interesting. Now, Joshua, we all know that your AI model, or anyone's AI model, not just yours, is only as good as the data that it's been trained upon. But there are also some ethical considerations there. How do we go about maintaining data security and user privacy while still using these data points that are available to us to really refine the model?
That's a really, really good question. And maybe kind of goes back to, in a previous life, I ran a company called Super Awesome, and it was all about child safety, so lots of safety concerns. And one of the frameworks that I tried to apply at the time was to try and take a step back outside of technology, which is what are the norms that we have established as a society? Because some of these topics are really hard to discuss. And when you talk about child safety, everyone instantly goes to, well, you surely can't take any risk. That's not productive as a discussion. Like, as parents, we would be okay with maybe letting a child 10 meters away from where we are if they're a year and a half. They might stay over with a friend when they're a little bit older, once you know the people. And so we have developed these norms of how we think about security and safety. And I think in terms of bias here, there is something similar that we have to do. We can't be talking about black and white. There is no such thing when you're talking about bias. I mean, if anything, the discourse today publicly is one of very strong misinformation and lots of everyone questioning what the truth is in the first place. This happened before Gen AI. Everyone's trying to put it inside this thing about it's AI's fault. It was here way before. Mm-hmm. So I'd say the biggest questions we have to solve are, first and foremost, how do we as a society evaluate what is the right approach to begin with? Then we can try and put those rules back onto AI. What we definitely don't want to have happen is what happened in the last 6 months, is that you have two or three big players that, because globally we've not figured out how to do this, they end up making their own decisions, and then you end up with biased models because nobody's telling them what to do either. So I hope that we'll have a much faster and much more robust discussion from that perspective, and then we can tell the models what are the guidelines that we want to have applied.
And we're getting toward the end of our time, so I want to make sure we go through and ask each of you any final thoughts, but I'd also love to know, what are you looking forward to in the future when it comes to education and all of this emerging technology? So I'll start with you, Metti.
I think for me, it's one word, is accessibility. I really hope that by the next 2 or 3 decades that every single student in the world have access to education, and I truly believe education, AI, and what we don't know yet, because AI wasn't a thing 10 years back, now it's a hot topic, will enable and empower students around the world, irrespective of where they're born, what is their gender, that they have to minimum access of the minimum access to minimum basic education through technology or classrooms.
And Mary, what about you? Where do you think we'll be in the future? Will we be happy about how we handled ourselves during this moment in time?
Well, I think we need to begin to measure what we treasure, and that requires a little bit of reflection. What is education for? So that's a long discussion. And I think I just had a wonderful opportunity in India to work with the C20 to put forward an education proposal to G20. And they wanted my involvement because they wanted empathy for a global representation of what education should control in the next. But I just have to say, listening to these wonderful experts' bookends here, that in the last decade, neuroscience crashed into, I think, our social world. And now I think technology, and I think it must be the collision metaphor is working, the technology is crashing into neuroscience and social science. And I think it's a very good thing, and let's measure it.
And Joshua, we'll give you the final word.
Well, so I think a lot of people are talking about generative AI and what are the implications around marketing and text generation there. I think that is one of the areas. I actually think education and learning is the space that is going to be revolutionized by everything that's happening at the moment. And I'm very excited by it. I literally now dedicate my life to it, because I think the ripple effects that get created when people are able to learn faster, learn better, and have a wider range of views are hard to compare. And what we have here with this new technology is what people have been trying to get to for 15 years, which is a true personalized coach that helps you get to that feedback loop. Mm. For the first time, we actually have the tech that delivers on the promise, and that is something that I'm extremely excited by.
Wonderful. Well, thank you everyone for a great discussion, and thank you for joining us.
Thank you.